This is really a remarkable book that has gone on to sell more than a million copies. And this was, let's see, over a million sold. And this was back in, my copy is older than yours, 93. So there must be at least 2 million copies now. And of course, today, we really start out with a question of what theologians call prolegomena. It's the beginnings. It's the introduction. It's why are we doing what we're doing and what's the methodology that we're going to be following? And so this is to see why is the study of God important? And he has a wonderful preface there to show us that it's not thought to be very important today. But he wants, first of all, to show us the difference between the traveler and the balconeer, as he calls him or them, the person sitting up on a balcony. And it's a wonderful, he creates a wonderful visual scene. You can picture someone up on a balcony in some great European city. And then you see down below are the travelers who are embarking on a journey, on a trip. And you have the difference between those two and their perspective. They're looking at the same street. They're looking at the same journey. But the difference between the two is remarkable. What is that difference? Do you remember the beginning, the preface where he brings those two images of the traveler and the balconeer? Well, what is it that, let's say, just take an example of sin. How would the balconeer might be considering the question, how can God, who is augustly holy, who is perfectly just, allow sin, if he's also sovereign, into his plan? So that's the question of what theologians call theodicy. It's the justice of God, or justifying God, being both sovereign and allowing sin to come into his world. How can that happen? The balconeers are sitting there contemplating this theoretical question of theology, which is not an unimportant question. But the point of this book is that they, on the journey, are thinking, how can I overcome sin in my life? I'm on a journey now, I'm a pilgrim, and I want to overcome sin in my life. So both are thinking about God and how much he dislikes sin, how contrary he is to sin, but one is thinking about it at a very theoretical level, the other is thinking about it, how can I live before God from day to day? How can I put away sin? How can I be a holy traveler? How can I make my life be conformed to Christ? How do we do that? Well, this is what knowing God is all about. It's not knowing about God only. We have to know about God, but we want to know about God so that we can actually know God himself. That's what Packer is getting at. And of course, what tradition is Packer particularly? Remember, he's an Anglican. But what theological tradition is Packer most famous for that has really molded and shaped his own thinking throughout his career? He's, by the way, I think in his mid-90s now and still writing, still working. The Puritans, this is what he has written about his entire career. Once he got bitten by the Puritan bug, he became what I think is probably the greatest scholar of Puritanism in the 20th and early 21st centuries. And there are other great scholars of post-Reformation theology, which people like Richard Muller at Calvin Seminary and others. But he is one who is not only a scholar of the Puritans, but he has written dozens and dozens of practical books showing the importance to the Puritans of knowing God and living holy lives that are dependent on him. And so that is the topic. And so behind the book lies a conviction, if you look on page 12, and by the way, you should bring the book to class because I want to have you referring to it, and we'll be looking at different pages since we don't have and will not have a handout. And so there are two unhappy trends, as he calls them, in the modern world that we face if we are serious about being faithful Christians and following after this wonderful Puritan model of piety. And those two unhappy trends, first of all, on page 112, a little bit below the center of that page, are, first of all, Christian minds have been conformed to the modern spirit. Conformed to the modern spirit. And what is he getting at here now? We think about knowing God. There was a thing written years ago by a man named Paul Little, who was a great campus minister. I think he was either InterVarsity or Campus Crusade that he worked with. But in any case, he wrote a famous book called Your God is Too Small. And I think that sums up what he's saying here, is that in the modern world, when we think of accomplishments, of great things that have been done, what do we think of? We think of men and women. We think of technology. We think of Bill Gates. We think of Steve Jobs. We don't think of God. It's not where the modern world is aimed. So the modern world, more than in any other era of human history, has completely flattened the environment. It's all about man. It's all horizontal. There's nothing else going on above. There's no vertical reality. And in fact, those who think there is are simply have sort of friendly illusions about what's going on. Of course, if one follows what's happening right now in Iraq and Syria with the Islamic State, you will realize that not every understanding or belief in God is friendly or harmless. But the modern temper is to think that it's all horizontal, it's all just about man, and any religious things are sort of, they're imagined. They're not real. There's nothing above the horizon of human life and accomplishment. And so God then, as he puts it there on that page, is allowed to become remote. He's remote, he's irrelevant, and the idea of thinking about the ultimate meaning of life is completely put aside. I was just having a conversation with myself this morning and thinking about talking to someone who basically would say that words have no ultimate meaning. And this is where, logically, where the modern world comes to. If there's no transcendent reality, if there's no living and true God, then ultimately, blah, 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 we're talking gobbledygook. That's all we've got. We have nothing of meaning. We can't possibly have a conversation. But the fact that we can have a conversation and do have a conversation with unbelievers shows that there is ultimate meaning and that they have no way of accounting for it. They're bereft of a way of accounting for it. So God, in his greatness, however, one thing the modern mind is not bereft at is being able to push thoughts of God aside, repressing and suppressing the knowledge of God, as Paul says, Romans 1. That's what the modern mind, and that's what all unbelieving minds throughout history have done so well, pushing God to the periphery. And I think we've done better than any other generation in doing that, which is so dangerous. Because what we're doing, as he says here at the bottom of the page, is we're ignoring thoughts about death, eternity, judgment, the greatness of the soul, and the abiding consequences of temporal decisions that are all out for moderns. And it is a melancholy fact that the Christian church, instead of raising its voice to remind the world of what is being forgotten, has formed a habit of playing down these themes in just the same way. And of course, this brings us to the second point, and that is the Christian minds have been confused by modern skepticism. And so we're skeptical about even the possibility of truth. There is no truth, and there is no right and wrong. It's interesting, a couple summers ago, I had a conversation with someone who was saying it's all socially qualified. It all depends on the society you live in. There's no ultimate right and wrong. There's no ultimate standard where you can say this is absolutely right or wrong in every culture at all times and everywhere in the world. Presently, I would bring another illustration, but I said, how about sexually abusing children? Would that ever be right in any culture, at any time, in any place? And this person said, you got me, because that was the end of the conversation. But you got me, because it's so easy, actually, to prove that there is right and wrong. And, of course, the only way to account for right and wrong is that there is ultimately God who is holy, who is just. The other one we could use is it ever right for a terrorist army to behead innocent people that are actually there to help them in terms of helping Muslims that are suffering? Is it ever right to do that in any place, at any time, by anyone? Of course it isn't. But the modern world likes to, in a very frivolous way, say that there is no truth. And, of course, the Bible, above all things, is not true. The Bible is simply a book of fiction. It's simply a book that was written in order to help weak people make it through life. And that's what the modern world believes. And, of course, related to this is the question of technology, which is not something he immediately refers to here. But the question of technology and popular culture, if you look around and see the ways in which we get diminished in the church, that these great questions of life become minimized, is that we import popular culture into the church, especially into its worship. So that essentially there's nothing different from the way we do our worship than watching Saturday Night Live or watching American Idol. That's what the worship has become. And so where is the distinction? The form needs to reflect the substance of what we're doing, and therefore it means that worship is a serious business. It's not something that is meant to entertain us. And so I think this is all related to this question of the Christian mind. In a sense, these two unhappy trends are trends that really are related to one another, conforming to the modern spirit and confused by modern skepticism. What is his answer to the question of what should we do? What should we do when we see skepticism all around us? What are we supposed to do in light of that? Ron. Yeah, that's another very important theme, juvenilization of culture. And Bergler wrote, the juvenilization of American Christianity, and especially focusing on youth groups and the nature of them, what's dangerous about them and what's also can be very healthy and good about them. But the trend of juvenilization is a major theme in our culture. And in American culture and the Western culture, I think, generally, but especially in American culture. So there are many different aspects of the ways in which we've taken on the mentality of the world around us, and we need to be very careful to distinguish that and to know that this is very, very important then in order to realize that we're not wasting our time going through these 286 pages that, as he says, this is the most important thing that we can do, to study the Godhead, to study the Trinity, the contemplation of divinity. Bill? A couple things there. One is that Protagoras in ancient times, back in the beginnings of Greek philosophy, said man is the measure of all things. And of course, this is a problem, not a solution. And so it shows us that this idea of making all reality ultimately human reality and horizontal is an old one. The difference is that in the modern world, we have electricity and we have electronics. And so the idea that man is the measure of all things, the accomplisher of all things, is now pervasive in a way that it never has been in human history up to the point when the telegraph was invented in the mid-19th century. And that's number one. Number two is what you're saying is we have to pay attention to the Bible. And, of course, that's exactly where all of the study of God comes from. If there's no Bible, there's no revelation of who God is that we as sinners can receive, because we need redemption, which is the great message of the Bible. And so he'll be going into that in great detail here in the subsequent pages. But now he's talking, if you begin in chapter 1 on page 17, he's talking about the effects. There are three wonderful effects that the contemplation of divinity or of God brings. Three wonderful effects. What's the first of those? And in fact, I would say that the next two, there's a logic here. The next two cannot happen if you don't get the first one. What's the first effect? Studying the divinity of God, contemplating deity, What's the first thing that it should do to us as human beings? Exactly, Carl. Humble us. And that there's a danger that we can study things, and it's heady stuff. I mean, I have shelves just of systematic theology in my library, in my study, and it's very easy to get proud of that knowledge. But the first thing that it should do is to humble us and make us realize that we're created by God. We're dust. And it's not by our own strength that we exist. It's by God's amazing power to create us, number one, and then to sustain us. In Him we live and move and have our being. And so what's interesting about the contemplation of God, it's funny, back about 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote an editorial in Ordained Servant about mystery, the place of mystery in the Christian life and in theology. And someone called me up, it was actually a former professor, and was kind of troubled by this, because it seemed like mystery was being emphasized too much, that there's stuff we can know, it's true truth, as Francis Schaeffer used to say. And I completely agree with that, and in the article I make it quite plain that the mysterious dimension of understanding God makes us all the more thankful for what we can understand that He's revealed to us in His Word. But I would say that the first thing He's revealed is that He is God, and that we should be utterly amazed at how wonderful and beyond our complete grasp He is. And pride is fostered by the things that we can control and grasp. Okay, I always feel very proud when I can solve a computer problem, because it was not my first love or ability. But we control those things. And look at people who write software programs, you know, that have invented the computer and are doing all the amazing things that are being done today with technology, and especially in the medical world, which is wonderful. But that stuff we can control, and it makes us want to go, wow, you know, we're really wonderful. Human beings are wonderful. Well, we're only wonderful to the degree that God made us in His image. And in our pride, we're not comfortable with mystery, that which we cannot control. And there are some aspects of life which we cannot control. We will never be able to control. God alone is sovereign over these things. And so humility is so, so important when we come to study the doctrine of God. And the second thing, that it expands the mind and enlarges the soul. So, you know, the people would say, oh, you know, what a waste of time that is. It's so irrelevant. Well, it's irrelevant if God is not my creator and redeemer. But if He is, then, as Packer says, there is nothing more relevant than the study of deity. Nothing more relevant. That is the most relevant thing for any human being to study. And particularly, as he says, the doctrine of Christ, His person and work, the doctrine of the Trinity. There's nothing more wonderful, more expanding to the soul and to the intellect. And I think about just the ways in which my mind has been expanded by becoming a Christian. It's amazing, exploring different areas that I would have just been a dummy if I hadn't become a Christian. Now, not to say that a genius is a genius, whether he's a Christian or not, okay? So you look at some of the geniuses that we have in the world, and that's true. But their genius only has a field that is very, very limited. And whereas we have a field that includes God Himself, that's remarkable. And what's also remarkable is that in the Bible that He gave us, in His Word, He's given us truth about Himself and the way that He deals with us, which we can understand and grasp and lay hold of and take a stand on and know for sure. And so the doctrine of mystery is not to say that there is no truth that we can understand. It's only to humble us in our understanding of it. The third thing is that, and I just said this really, is it comforts the mind. So in the midst of sorrow, grief, fear, the knowledge of God brings solace. It brings, what's the word he uses? It's consolatory. It brings consolation. And it brings happiness. It brings cheer in the midst of a sorrowful world. It brings comfort when we are sorry or grief-stricken. And it brings meaning when it appears in the modern world especially, that life is simply meaningless. All of that is on pages end of 17 and on to 18. And there we have the effects of contemplation of divinity. So in a sense, we should keep those kind of in the back of our minds as we're going through this study, because those ought to always be in play, and we ought to especially check ourselves when we think about humility. Is this doctrine making me humble? And then, is it expanding my soul? And is it bringing me real practical comfort and strength in the face of life's difficulties? One might also add, I mean, you could write a book, and so the Puritans certainly have, on this third point, that it also gives us wisdom. God gives us wisdom. When we come to contemplate Him, it gives us wisdom to live. Proverbs is a wonderful example of wisdom for living the believing life. And God gave us that wisdom. And as we read it, we realize that this wisdom of how to navigate the terribly difficult and perplexing problems of human life, it's there. He's given it to us. We can navigate by His wisdom and by His grace. Now we go to a question at the bottom of 18. Who needs theology? Who needs theology? It's interesting he used theology instead of doctrine, but both of those words are seeing hard times. You know, doctrine, and there are many places and many Christians and churches that you raise that question. It's just like, it's theoretical, it's not practical, it's boring is the other thing, because it does take work to study, but it's boring and irrelevant to my life. And this is where he makes a strong plea to say that to disregard, on page 19, the study of God, you sentence yourself to stumble and blunder through life, blindfolded, as it were, with no sense of direction and no understanding of what surrounds you. This way, you can waste your life and lose your soul. What a profound statement. How important the knowledge of God and the study of theology. Theology, by the way, the word simply comes from the Greek theos logos, and simply means the study of God. And one might say, well, how can we study God? God can study us, but can we study God? And yeah, we can. He's invited us to in His Word. He tells us to know Me. Come before Me and repent and believe on Me, and I will have mercy and I will give you life. So He's invited us to study Him in order that we might live life not blindly, but through the light that He gives in the gospel and in all of His Word. I love His imagery. To say it's not practical means that we don't think we need guidance in life, that we don't think we need meaning or an ultimate goal. And of course, that is a terribly misguided understanding. And so, a question, what attitude does Packer say we should assume when someone tells us there is no road to knowledge about God? This is really getting back to the question, Bill, that you picked up on. I kind of asked it a little bit early. If the modern world says this is irrelevant, it's boring, you can't know the truth ultimately, you can't know God, it's all just speculation, it's empty speculation, what are we to do? He gives a wonderful image from Pilgrim's Progress and what Christian does when all the voices around him, including his own family, are saying, oh, don't waste your time doing this. You know, you should stay here in the city of destruction. It's a great place. You can have a lot of fun and enjoy life. And you can't know the truth. There's no such thing as knowing the truth. What does Christian say? There's a very famous line there as he's beginning his journey to the celestial city. He says, life, life, eternal life. And he blocks his ears and he runs out of town. And Packer is saying that that's what we should do. This is interesting because when I first read this, I went, you know, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't analyze the culture that we live in. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't seek to understand the age in which we live. I've spent the better part of the last 20 years trying to do that in terms of the electronic media. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't assess the world around us critically. But it's got to be done through the lens of the Bible. And if we don't put that first, then we're going to compromise and we're going to stay in the city of destruction, perhaps. And so I think that's what he's saying. He's certainly not saying, because he himself has written all kinds of books that have an answer to the modern world, to the problems and the skepticism of the modern world. What he's saying is, concentrate on the first thing, and that's God. And then we can face the world, we can navigate. And that's just what Pilgrim does. He goes, okay, I'm out of here. I'm following after the gospel. And we know the journey he took. At that point, he actually was under conviction of sin. He didn't actually know the Lord. He hadn't had the burden of guilt lifted off him with that tremendously heavy backpack that he had on. And so, concentrating, refusing to give in to the voices around us that are saying, you're wasting your time. Now, on page 20, he goes and gives us five fundamentals, foundational principles, five basic truths that he wants us to consider as we're going along. These aren't attitudes, which is what the three thing effects are that studying God should have on us on page 18. But now on page 20, these are five basic things by which we will plot our course throughout these studies. And so we need to be aware of what these are. I'm going to read these because they're so important, these five things. The first four are really statements about God, and the fifth is how he then, that knowledge of him, changes our lives and alters the way we live. First, God has spoken to man. The Bible is his word, given to us to make us wise unto salvation. You can tell this is a man who's done a lot of catechetical studies because his language is very concise and every word has meaning. God has spoken. I remember one of my favorite books that Francis Schaeffer wrote in his initial trilogy, The God Who Is There, Escape from Reason, and then the final one was He is There and He is Not Silent. So a wonderful statement. And I remember Schaeffer going over and doing a critique of Ingmar Bergman's film, The Silence, or maybe it's called just Silence. But it's a haunting film which really reflects the attitude of modernity that when it comes to God, there's just silence. There's no one there. And we need to just face the fact. And much modern existentialism takes that basic tack. And so he's saying, no, he is there. He is the true and living God. And he's not silent. He's spoken. We have his word. Secondly, what the Bible teaches us, of course, is that God is Lord and King over his world. He's sovereign. He's in control. He rules all things for his own glory, displaying his perfections in all that he does in order that men and angels may worship and adore him. See, actually, in each of these statements about God, notice he's already applying it along the way. God has spoken in the Bible. Why? To save us from sin, to make us wise unto salvation. God is Lord and King in order that we and angels should worship him. And the third one is that he is a Savior active in sovereign love through the Lord Jesus Christ to rescue believers from the guilt and power of sin and to adopt them as his children and bless them accordingly. So one of the most famous things he ever wrote was an introduction to John Owen, the famous theologian who was the chaplain in ordinary to Oliver Cromwell during his protectorate. He wrote this book on the death of Christ, Owen did. And so the death of death and the death of Christ, and he gives an introduction to that. If you've never read it, it's probably 25 or 30 pages long. It's magnificent. And he shows there, of course, how the death of Christ is applied to us, that God comes after us sovereignly, and he doesn't just make it possible for us to be saved. He actually works our salvation. So all of that's packed into active in sovereign love. And then he is triune. So the Godhead is one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Father is the one that purposes and plans our salvation. Remember, the covenant of redemption is the Father and the Son planning the covenant of grace and planning that he should come into the world, that he should live and die and rise again to be the representative of his people, to be the second Adam. And so the Father plans all of this with the Son. And the Son then comes into history, and he accomplishes our salvation. He actually does what needed to be done in order for us to be in relationship to God. And then finally, the Spirit does what? He's the one that applies it. He applies the purposes of the Father, the accomplishments of the Son, to our individual lives. It's an amazing reality. And then finally, he doesn't say God in five. He says godliness means responding to God's revelation in trust and obedience, faith and worship, prayer and praise, submission and service. Life must be seen and lived in the light of God's word. This and nothing else is true religion. I think that last statement is really the last two sentences under five. That's what the Puritans were all about. And what's interesting is if you looked at the 39 articles of the Church of England, you would see a true statement of Christian faith. It's nowhere near as extensive as the Westminster Confession, but it's a true statement of Christian faith. The problem is that in the days when the Puritans were emerging out of the Reformation, the church had become, it was so aligned with the state, as were all religious institutions in the medieval world. All of Christianity, or what is called Christendom, was connected with the state. And so the Reformation actually wouldn't have succeeded if it hadn't been for some rulers accepting the gospel, accepting the Reformed faith, and then protecting all of their citizens who believed it. But the problem is that it was so connected with the culture and the state in England that there was just loads of nominalism. That's one of the things I love about being a minister in New England. There's not much nominalism left because there's no cultural benefit to associating with the church. Like, let those Christians go off and do their useless, irrelevant thing. But in England, it was just the opposite. Everyone was a Christian. In fact, when we lived in the South back in the 70s for a time, it was that way. It still is to some degree. That everyone's a Christian. Of course I'm a Christian. I was born a Christian. I was baptized a Christian. And so that's why he ends this by saying, this and nothing else is true religion. True religion is lived before God. And that's what makes the difference. And so that was the passion of the Puritans and reason that they were willing to die for what they believed. So there you've got the five foundational principles. We've got to go back to those and remember, in a real sense, we won't have to remember them quite as much as the effect that studying God should have on us, because he's going to be just unpacking this over the next 21 chapters. That's what he's going to be up to. And so a seventh question would be, what should be our ultimate aim in studying the Godhead? Why does theological knowledge go bad on us if sought for its own sake? Now, we've talked about this a bit up to this point, but that's a question. How can it go wrong? Studying God? Studying Hodge's systematic theology or Calvin's Institutes? How can this be bad? How can we misuse that? Well, we've said it already, but some thoughts on that. I remember going to Covenant College and encountering young Calvinists. And Robin and I were still going through a journey. We were just coming to accept infant baptism, understand Presbyterianism. We were very new to it. And these who are a little bit less new, but as Balut said, that Michael Horton says that for the first several years when people become Reformed, they should be caged because they're dangerous. And I love that image, the caged Calvinist. And we met some students there at Covenant College that should have been caged, and they weren't. And we too, I'm sure, in different ways have fallen prey to that, especially early in the Christian life. But it can happen to you any time. Pride is always there in the human soul, dogging us. And it's that, I know more than you do. Isn't that wonderful? I'm so much wiser and smarter than you. And that's what we do by nature. Now, we don't do it as obviously as that, but it makes us feel like we're better than other Christians. They're really kind of, those non-reformed Christians are kind of second-class Christians. Instead of having the attitude of, the Lord is opening by his grace to me this knowledge that humbles me and also comforts me and enlarges my soul. I would love to share this with others because it's wonderful riches. But it's not because I'm better. It's because God is amazing. Two different, totally different attitudes. And of course, we're always going to struggle with the pride thing. But the idea that we're better than others, and it's native to the human condition. It's not just a Christian problem. It's a human problem. And if you look around, you see that everyone in the sinful world has different ways of making themselves feel superior. And so we just have to remember that. And again, that goes back to how does the contemplation of divinity affect us? If it affects us properly, it humbles us. And now he also goes and looks at Psalm 119. He looks at several other scriptures here. Now we're over on page 22. Coming near the end of this first chapter. And well, let's read what he quotes. Actually, just going back to that last point, he quotes 1 Corinthians 8, 1 and 2. Knowledge puffs up. The man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know. So there's a direct hit at our pride from Paul in 1 Corinthians 8. But then he says, but there's no spiritual health without doctrinal knowledge. But it is equally true that there can be no spiritual health with it if it is sought for the wrong purpose and valued by the wrong standard. And then he goes on to say in the next paragraph, but, says someone, is it not a fact that a love for God's revealed truth and a desire to know as much as we can are natural to every person who has been born again? So, see, he doesn't want to leave us with that negative point because you could say, well, it puffs up, it leads to pride, and I've heard non-reformed people say this, therefore, why study it? And sadly, maybe all they've ever encountered is Calvinists that should have been caged. We don't know. But he doesn't want to leave us with that. He wants to say, yes, knowing as much as we can about the Lord is the instinct and the desire of people that are born again. So we don't only have that principle of pride that dogs us, I'm better than everyone else, but we have a new principle of life being reborn, being regenerated, that says, I want to know God more because he's God and he saved me. That's a good instinct. And if you remember our sermons on Psalm 119 in the evening, it repeats it in those 176 verses. It's repeated over and over again how the psalmist is saying, oh, Lord, I want to know you better. Help me, strengthen me, give me wisdom. My enemies are just about to kill me, and I want you to guide me. I want you to be the inspiration, the strength of my life. So Psalm 119, and then he quotes from five verses, probably could have quoted from many more, Psalm 119, 12, 18, 97, 103, and 125 says this, teach me your decrees. Open my eyes that I may see wonderful things in your law. Oh, how love I thy law, or how love I your law. He's quoting from the NIV, by the way. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to the mouth. And then finally, give me discernment that I may understand your statutes. And so truly, we do have that God-given desire. And so kept in check, if we keep pride in check, wanting to know as much as we can about the Lord is a wonderful thing and something that we are truly called to pursue. And a final question then, as we're coming near the end of our hour, is how can we turn our knowledge about God into knowledge of God, and what does it mean to meditate? How do you personally respond to Packer's description of meditation, which is now over on the last page of this chapter, which is page 23? It's interesting. Back in the 70s, at least, it's still there, of course, in the culture, but I haven't seen a lot of things written on it. But I remember Ed Clowney, who was a Westminster professor and the president at the time, had written something on Christian meditation. Because when I was in the counterculture, meditation was an Eastern mystical activity. And so, what's the difference between those two? Not important, because the word meditate is there in the Bible, so we know that there's a Christian version of meditation. Bill? That's a wonderful statement, to think God's thoughts after him. And thank you for reminding us of that, Bill, because it reminded me of, and I think this is where Van Til gets it, Philippians 4, verse 8, Paul says, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. So that's what Packer is saying. To meditate, Christian meditation, is to think about God and all that He's revealed in His Word to us. Eastern meditation, for me, ended up being the void, like you said, and trying to imagine that I'm part of the great one, the great unity of all things. That was never comforting to me. And then, furthermore, you're looking inside. You're not looking to God outside of you, but inside. And that, too, was never comforting. So thank God that there is another kind of meditation. And I might add in closing that the modern world particularly unsuits us for meditation. It distracts us constantly. I just had to work on something that I'm writing yesterday, and every once in a while I think of email. No, you're not going to go look at your email. It's totally distracting, and people that talk about multitasking, that's an illusion, because it's been proven with many, many studies that multitasking wastes time. Because I remember that in architecture, you know, working and getting interrupted by people. It's a phone call. It's someone from the construction crew coming in. And it takes, they say, 5 to 10 minutes, depending on the complexity of the topic, for you to get back to where you were. And so meditation, you need to have a place in your home where you can sit undistracted. And if the phone rings, unless you know someone's calling you for an important purpose, let your answering service take it and meditate. Stop. Don't check that email. Leave your smartphone on your desk somewhere else or on the kitchen table and get away from it all and think on these things. It's such an important thing for us to do. And as he ends up this first chapter, he says, God help us then to put our knowledge about God to this use that we all may in truth know the Lord. So I hope you'll be continuing to study with me. And next week we have the people who know their God. And this is there's a few pages here, 32. So we've got probably 8 pages. And study it, meditate on it over the coming week, and then come with questions. We still do have a couple minutes left if you want to ask questions at this point or make comments thus far. There are no mysteries. Of course there are. You must have a question, Bill. Actually, that's why confessions are so important, that doctrine unites if it's biblical doctrine, if it's true doctrine. And it's very interesting. Chad Van Dixhorn has come out with a new book, and I can't think of the title of it, but it's on the Westminster Confession. He did his doctorate. It's the only doctorate that I've ever known that was 7 volumes. So this kid really took the Westminster Confession seriously. But he realized that deep study on some of the debates that happened was not that thorough, really. And so he found a whole new terrain to explore. So he ended up over at Cambridge University and doing and exploring all the papers. They're all there, the papers of the talk about the debates. And he's put all that together. And Oxford University Press has published it. It's a bunch of volumes, and it costs like $900 for this set. But it's very important, and for one reason, even if you've never read any of it, to know that all that goes into our confessional statements was hotly debated. 5 years of debate. And these were the brightest minds in the English-speaking and actually some from the Dutch-speaking world that we had in theology. These were people of incredible genius in many cases. And so what they did is, it was a compromise. Now, mention that word and some people, and they, you know, it's like a red flag in front of a bull, but it's a compromise document. That is to say that the things that were debatable, that they couldn't come to agree, this is clear in the Bible. They said, we won't put there because we want to unite Christendom. And so the things that are there, all 33 chapters, are the things that these divines coming from Scotland, they're a tough bunch, and the English church and then some from the continental church, they agreed on these things. They agreed, this is what the Bible clearly teaches. And so doctrine unites. I know I've encountered the same thing, and I probably many in this room have encountered that same thing, that doctrine divides, theology puffs up. And we first of all can say, it can, if it's not biblical. But look at what a confession is. Let me explain to you what went into our confession. And it's interesting that the minimal one-page confession that most evangelical churches have leads to confusion because it doesn't say enough. And so that's what divides when people are left to have their own opinions about things. But I think also showing people how practically important it is. So what's the nature of what Jesus did on the cross? Oh, that's doctrine. That's theology. Doctrine. It's simply biblical teaching. And dear brother or sister, do you not think that biblical teaching is important? Oh, yeah, well, I do. Well, that's what doctrine is. So I think it takes time. That's a question that really takes time to convince people of the importance of theology. And maybe just give them a copy of Knowing God. Packer has been an academic all of his career, and yet he has such a wonderful pastoral flavor to everything that he does. And I think the reason is that the most academic of the Puritans were always pastoral, and that's what makes it so unique.